Welcome to Hochoka Podcast.
Strength and resilience. These are perhaps two sides of the same coin. The Apostle Paul would say, "In my weakness, I am strong." Let's hear what Joseph Marshall III says about the traditional Lakota bow and arrow and the power that comes in overcoming adversity. Hello, Mataki Apie, and welcome to Hochoka here at the center of St. Joseph's Indian School's campus. I'm Scott Wooster, today's Hochoka host. Joseph Marshall III, a frequent Hochoka guest, a historian, writer, teacher, craftsman, administrator, actor, and public speaker, continues the conversation begun earlier on lessons in resilience from the bow and arrow. Joseph, always wonderful to have you with us.
Great to be here again. Thank you.
Absolutely. I like this phrase, and I think it's very powerful. Quote, "The world would be sad without us who are Lakota."
Right.
There must always be Lakota in the world.
In the world.
Would you tell our audience about this and what it means to you?
I heard that in various forms from a lot of elders, who had a very good awareness, good sense of identity, about who they were, and what that meant in terms of our, you know, journey throughout life and our relationship with Mother Earth or the environment. Looking back on what I know about Lakota people, we developed a relationship with the natural environment, what we call Grandmother Earth, by trial and error. We learned what worked, we learned what didn't. Mm-hmm. We learned the whims and the cycles of natural environment, and we adapted to it, and we became part of it. And that was our strength. That's at the core of who we are. We didn't make the world over to suit us. We adapted to it, and that's where our strength came from. And we evolved as a culture because of that. And we formed a very strong identity, again, based on everything around us. And if there was ever a moment when there were no more Lakota, then all those teachings, all that knowledge would be gone. As Lakota people, we have something to offer the rest of the world. Not to change everybody else into what we think, but to add what we know to the common knowledge that's out there in the whole world.
Yeah.
Because of our experience, because of where we lived and how we lived, we add to the story of humanity. And I think all kinds of people can say that, no matter where we're from.
Right.
No matter where we live, no matter what our philosophies are. We all contribute to the whole, to the commonality of what life is all about or should be on this planet. So when you take one part away and it's gone, it affects everybody else.
Right.
So that's what that means to me. If there is no more Lakota in the world would be sad without us. It would be lesser.
Yes.
Without us.
Absolutely. I agree. 100%. And relating to lessons from the bow and arrow, you actually recall the exact moment that you equated the stave of the green ash bow in the fire with life.
Right.
Can you explain that or yeah, that moment?
There are two ways to craft a bow. One is to harvest a tree, split it, and then hang it up somewhere to dry for 3 years or 4 years, and wait for the wood to cure and become dry so that you begin to work on it. And it takes patience to do that.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Yes. But there's always, you know, staves in the drying, as
yeah.
it were. One way is to take that stave when it's green, split it, and work on it immediately. But the only thing is you can carve it, but you can't bend the stave. You can't bend it. You can't split the fibers. But you still need to dry it when you finish carving the bow. So what happens is that you build a fire and a long bed of coals, and coals provide more heat than a roaring fire believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When you have a long bit of coals and then you hang the stave or the bow over it so many feet, and then you turn it over every now and then, over a period of 2 or 3 days, you have to keep the fire going, you have to keep the stave above it, and you watch it. And when the green stave starts to turn a little yellow, then you know it's drying out. As I was watching that process, after, you know, maybe the fourth or fifth time I'd ever done it in my life, and by that time I was a young adult, I realized that this is what life is. The heat that is drying the bow to make it strong is all the trials and tribulations of life as it affects us. Because we're like that green bow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we grow up and we're taught and shaped and influenced by our family and our community, and we reach a level where life takes over more and more as we go out in the world and experience things, and all the things that we do, all the things that we don't do, all the mistakes we make, all the experiences we have, that's what life is. That's what that fire is.
Mm-hmm.
It hardens that green stave until it can become a functioning bow. And that's what happens to us.
Right.
It's the same thing. It's what life is all about.
You close that chapter on strength by speaking about the theme of a growing loss of wisdom amongst the elders. How does that, can you tell us about that, how it might relate to that theme of strength?
I grew up with a lot of elders around me in my formative years, my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, and eventually my paternal grandparents as well. But the people that they knew, that we were related to, came into our lives frequently, either to come to visit or when we socialized with them at some kind of an event or whatever happened. In the course of my upbringing up until the time I was, you know, 12 or 13 years old. So that early influence was predominantly from older people, older than me. And as I grew up to respect them, I grew up to learn to treasure who they were as individuals and what they had to offer. And this was looking years back. When you're a child, you don't think of those things. But when you get older and you look back on your life, you realize, you know, at one moment or two or several, that was an important juncture in my life. What that person said resonated with me years later. I have a lot of those kind of memories. But what I learned is how much that my grandparents and their contemporaries knew about life, about things, about how to do something. You know, the amount of knowledge they had was astounding to me. It still is. It still is. And still in those days, my parents' generation respected the elders. Not so much anymore. But in those days, it still was. Fast forward to now, we don't think of elderly people in the same way. We put them out to pasture. At a certain age, we become useless. We can't do physically the things that we once did as fast anymore as we once did, or as well as we once did. But in Lakota society, before reservations, before the influence of white culture, when a person reached a certain age, then he or she became even more valuable because of knowledge and experience, because of what they contributed. In most communities, there was a council of elders, of older men, who, by the way, it wasn't just the older men who were influential. They were influenced by their wives and their grandmothers and so forth. But they were the ones who were those elderly people were all the font of advice and wisdom. Since the situation came up, it was the elders who talked about it for a long time sometimes. And then they would never tell anybody else what to do. They would say, this is what we think. So when a group of elders who have centuries of wisdom among them apply that knowledge to a given situation and then say, this is what you think, we're going to pay attention because we realize how valuable it is that what they say is based on experience, based on knowledge, not so much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So when we lose that, if we put that aside in today's society, we're losing a resource that's just priceless.
Right.
And, you know, to me, that's one of the greatest sins of modern society is we ignore the wisdom of elders.
Right. And don't live as close to them.
And don't live as close to them as we once did. I grew up with elders. And there was a time when children and grandchildren had easy access to one another
mm-hmm.
all the time. But, you know, we scatter like the wind these days.
Yep.
We're all over the place. Careers take us here and there, whatever. So we don't have that connection anymore.
Right.
To our grandparents.
Absolutely.
That generation.
You say a bow is drawn many, many times to send its arrows, which I have to say you're going to explain it to me, so I don't understand that yet, you know, because you think, well, you pull right. the bow and the arrow goes. Tell us about Red Leaf and what that might mean to her.
Right. a well-made bow can last a long time.
Mm-hmm.
If it's tapered just right and every time you draw it, if each limb pulls back equally, then the stress on one limb is the same as the stress on the other
mm-hmm.
limb. Because every time you pull that bow back, what you're doing is on the outer side of it, you're stretching the fibers.
Mm-hmm.
You're pulling them apart. We don't see it, but that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, on the inside, you're compressing.
Okay, yeah.
So there is a definite physical impact on that bow every time you draw it back.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, I suppose if you draw back far enough, then eventually the wood is going to fatigue and it's going to come apart.
Mm-hmm.
I have a bow that I made, several actually, but one I made back in 2008.
Okay.
I still shoot it.
Yeah.
It's a hickory bow. I don't know how many times I've shot that bow, but conservatively, probably 10,000 times
okay.
I've drawn that bow
wow.
back.
Wow, yeah. To shoot.
Yeah. And send an arrow.
Yep.
So that's how many times it's faced that particular adversity.
Yep.
And it's still the same bow.
Yeah.
It's still doing well.
Yeah.
Someday maybe. I may just hang it up and retire it one
right.
of these times.
Right.
But there was an old woman that lived near us, actually, you know, several miles from us. In a story, I give her the name of Red Leaf. But in real life, her name was Redshirt. That was her husband's name. And she lived by herself near the highway. And whenever we went into town, we would stop by and visit her. And we would bring her food because she was blind.
Mm-hmm.
She lived about 60 yards from the river. And she laid out a path for herself to the river so she could follow that path, you know, to go and get water from the river. And people helped her pile wood in a certain place so she could know where to go and get wood, where the kindling was.
Mm-hmm.
Everything in her house was just in where she wanted so she could go and fend for herself and start her own fire and
mm-hmm.
so forth. But we would stop and visit with her. And I was always sort of intimidated by her, one, because her hair was snow white and her eyes were clouded over so she couldn't see. And every now and then she would have these strips of red wool in her hair that she would break because the hair was snow white. So you could tell, not every time we went, but every mm-hmm. now and then she would have these strips of red wool in her hair, braided into her hair.
Yep.
And I was curious about that. My grandmother said, well, ask her. So finally one day I did work up the nerve. Keep in mind I was like 6 years old
right.
at the time.
Right, yeah.
I said, Grandma, why is that red in your hair? And she said, well, bring me a cup of coffee and I'll tell you. So I poured a cup of coffee, took it to her. I sat with her in a certain place. She had me sit so she could know where I was. And she told me the story, how the red thing, red strips were in her hair. She was 6 years old in 1876. And so I don't know how old she was then, but she was 6 years old in 1876. Mm-hmm. She was with her family at Greasy Grass, mm-hmm. now known as Little Bighorn, when the soldiers attacked. Mm-hmm. So her father took off, got on his horse, grabbed his weapon, took off, and they didn't know where he was. There was a lot of confusion. There was a battle going on. They could hear the guns blasting to the south of the village, and everybody was confused and of course, afraid, because, mm-hmm. White soldiers, the Long Knives, didn't have a very good reputation as mm-hmm. far as, the Lakota people were concerned. Eventually, the battle shifted from the south to the north. It was going on further to the north, and so this little girl's grandmother grabbed her by the hand and said, "We're going to look for your father." So they went up north through the village, which was a very long village, and eventually crossed at a certain spot and went up a long slope. And in the flow of the battle, there's a ridge called Last Stand Ridge, and the soldiers were being chased along that ridge. And they got up there just in time to see warriors chasing the soldiers mm-hmm. along that ridge. So they stood on a little plateau and watched. And the battle was going on about a quarter of a mile from them. So they were very close. Mm-hmm. They could hear everything. They could see what was happening. So this girl's grandmother started to sing songs, what are called strongheart songs, to encourage the fighting men. Mm-hmm. She stood there and sang and sang and sang to encourage the warriors. And some of the warriors saw that. And Redshirt was there with her grandmother. She was there, standing with her grandmother, witnessing all of this. Mm-hmm. And eventually the battle moved further to the north, and then it ended. There was no more firing. It was quiet. And they waited there to see what would happen. And several of the warriors who had seen this old woman singing came back. Some of them were elite warriors. Some of them were Crazy Dog warriors. Some of them were Cheyenne Dog soldiers. Mm-hmm. And each of them had a sash, a red sash, that they would wear around their waists. At the end was a peg, long chokecherry peg. And the reason they wore that, it was long. It's probably about 20 feet long. They would wrap it around their waist. And they would sometimes unwrap it and peg that down to where they were standing and fighting. And that's where they would fight. They would stand and fight, either until they got killed or they won. Mm-hmm. Either way.
Yeah.
And those kinds of men saw this old lady standing there singing. And a couple of them took off their sashes and gave them mm-hmm. to this old woman.
Yeah.
For singing their songs and encouraging them.
Right.
So that's how Red Shirt got the red ribbons. Later on, her grandmother cut off a strip and gave it to her and said, this is yours. Mm-hmm. So she put it away, and eventually she cut it into strips, and she would every now and then wear it in her hair to think about her grandmother.
Yeah.
So by me asking a simple question, she told me that story. But I realized that, she was a blind lady, and she lived every day after her husband died by herself. And she even lost a son, I think, in World War II. One of her sons was killed in World War II. So she knew adversity throughout her life, and blindness was certainly an adversity. Mm-hmm. Facing life every day as a blind person is an adversity. Mm-hmm. But she managed.
Yeah.
She did it on her own, most of the time on her own.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that equated to my bow or any bow being drawn over and mm-hmm. over again and stressed to the limit.
Yeah.
So those two are the same lessons in life.
Absolutely. About right. that resiliency.
The resilience.
In your family, you have some examples of,
sure.
we all do, but
we
I
all
mean,
do.
You,
yeah.
you do in your life that are examples yeah. of that resiliency. And they're beautiful lives and beautiful stories. Mm-hmm. Can you share one or two of those?
Sure. and it starts with both my grandmothers. I mean, they My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, lost her father and her sister and her younger sister when she was younger.
Mm-hmm.
So it impacted her. And she would like to tell me the story of her younger sister when she died in the Spanish influenza epidemic back in 1918.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how many times she told it, to her it almost seemed like it happened the day before.
Right.
And she always cried.
Yeah.
She always made me cry when she told the story. So that's one example. And my paternal grandmother, same way. I happened to be with her the day that news was brought that her son had died of an accidental gunshot.
Mm-hmm.
And she took the news, you know, very gracefully but hard. Shocked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could see it on her face, you know, the shock. But also with a lot of grace and with a lot of strength. And before that, in her earlier life, she lost a husband and a son. And my Uncle Melvin was killed in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So she knew a lot of loss in her life, as sometimes we all do. And I have some aunts who have had difficult lives because they've experienced hardship in their lives, and some cousins who've lost children. I've never, thankfully, had the experience of losing a child, but they have, and I've seen firsthand the impact on them, you know, psychologically, emotionally, and how hard it was for them to cope with that.
Mm-hmm.
And grief doesn't go away.
No.
It stays with us all the time.
Yeah.
So they're always grieving, but they've sort of learned to cope with it. And that's the best thing we can do over the years. So we all face adversity in one form or another, some greater than others. If we're lucky, we don't face a lot of it, but still it comes in one form or another. So I think all we have to do is, like I do, just look to your family and you'll see examples of all those kinds of lessons in how they were, how they reacted, how they lived their lives, and what happened to them.
Right, in the midst of devastation.
In the midst of devastation, we you know, we persevere somehow.
Still put a foot in front of the
other.
Get up each day. So when life throws its worst at you, you face it with the best that you have. And should we finish up this episode with the Stone Carrier Society?
Sure. Yeah, I heard from a couple of sources, I heard this story, so the same version of it. And I heard it when I was a teenager about how one warrior society originated. There were warrior societies among the Lakota for various reasons or other. Only sons, if you were the only son of a family, then you were part of a society, you know. Or if you owned a white horse, there was a white horse owner society.
Yep.
There was all kinds of reasons to have a warrior society. But again, the whole purpose of a society was to exemplify what a protector was all about, or what a warrior was all about, all the best qualities. And this is a story of two men, one older and one younger, who were selected to go on a quest because they were at a time when people were questioning what the role of men were, what the role of a warrior was.
Mm-hmm.
So the elders selected these two men to go and to the west, from the prairies far to the west to some mountain ranges where there was a mountain of shiny black stone. And that shiny black stone was coveted because when they made very good arrow points and lance heads and knives and those kind of things, because they were made out of fire. The stone came obviously from volcanoes, but they were born of fire,
okay.
So they had that strength. So these two men were sent, and so they went west and eventually got there after some trials and tribulations. Happened to find the mountain of stone, which was now in Wyoming, and where Yellowstone Park is.
Mm-hmm.
There's obsidian deposits there. The stone is called obsidian.
Okay,
and I've made arrow points out of obsidian, and they're exquisite. They're sharp.
Yeah.
So that's what they went after. And they found them, and they found four pieces, and they were bringing them home. It was not an easy journey, but in the process, they witnessed things that they never thought they would witness. They saw, you know, geysers in Yellowstone, what was now Yellowstone. They saw mud pools. They saw different kinds of animals. And the whole journey to them was transformational in that it could have defeated them, but it didn't. Mm-hmm. They had a purpose, and they wanted to achieve it. They had doubts along the way sometimes. On the way home, they encountered some difficulty. One of the men was wounded by a wolverine, I think, slashed open his shoulder. So they had his companion had to find medicine to take care of him. And eventually, as they got closer to home, then they had an encounter with a bear. And for all intents and purposes, the older man was confronted by the bear, and he was just moments away from being torn apart by that bear. But the other man happened to be there with his bow and arrow in spite of his wounded shoulder. And believe it or not, the story said he's put an arrow through the eyes of the bear from the side and blinded the bear. And, of course, disabled the bear.
Yeah.
So they eventually killed the bear because he was blind, and they brought back his skull and his cape. But that experience, that quest, the difficulties they had to, the cold and the thirst and the hunger and all those miles of traveling on foot to what is now essentially central South Dakota to western Wyoming and back, really developed, obviously, the character of these two men, even though they had their doubts that they would ever make it. You know, they didn't. It was difficult, to say the least. So when they came back, the elders honored them. They made two lance points out of each of those stones and gave it to them. And the women of the village made a lodge for them. And they were the first two members of the Stone Carrier Society because of commemorating the trek that they made bring the stones back. And in order to be a member of that society, one had to make the trek.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not a very large warrior society.
Right.
Over the years, there were more and more, but there was never more than 10 or 12 members of that society.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the requirement. But to me, it's all about, you know, overcoming all kinds of odds. It was resiliency, it was strength, it's all those things that one can read into that journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So you hear the stories, and they do. They're so powerful. They grabbed you when you were a kid,
right?
And they grab you when you tell them now. And they, as listeners or readers now, they grab us with the story,
right.
But they also grab us with their lessons, exactly what they're supposed to do. So thank you for again sharing your stories.
My pleasure.
And thank you to our viewers for joining us here at Ho-Choka at the center of St. Joseph's Indian Schools campus, where we talk about issues that are central to Native American education today. Until next time, stay centered.